Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 266, an update on the European Union and the European Monetary Union. This program is being recorded on December 31st of the year 2000. Happy New Year and Happy Millennium to those of you who hear this program on tape. For quite some time, I've been discussing the European Monetary Union and the European Union, and specifically assessing the European Monetary Union as the realization of a pan-German theoretician named Friedrich Liszt's formula for German world domination through an economically united Europe under German domination that formulated in the 1840s and designed as a vehicle for German world domination. And again, I've been analyzing the European Monetary Union as the realization of the Liszt-ian theories as formulated in the 1840s. There are numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire that discuss the Liszt formula. It was last delineated at some length in For the Record program number 232, that is titled, Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War. There are other broadcasts that are available, and again, I will give the address, etc., for Spitfire at the end of the program. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that comes from the Financial Times of London of Thursday, December 7th of the year 2000. This is an article by Peter Norman in Nice. It's headlined, EU Aiming to Heal Old Divisions. Listen very carefully to this article because it's more than a little revealing. European Union leaders today embark on a historic summit aimed at strengthening the EU's decision-making capacity so that it can almost double its membership. If successful, the Nice summit will mark a further decisive stage in reversing the legacy of Second World War conferences at Tehran and Yalta. These condemned the continent to more than 40 years of Cold War division between East and West. But EU leaders face difficult negotiations in which they must give way on a variety of key national interests. Note this one sentence because this is very, very indicative indeed. If successful, the Nice summit will mark a further decisive stage in reversing the legacy of Second World War conferences at Tehran and Yalta. These condemned the continent to more than 40 years of Cold War division between East and West. In both the aforementioned For the Record program number 232 and in Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, I present my analysis that, in effect, in the years since the combat of World War II ended, much of the results of the Second World War have, in fact, been politically reversed. And for those who find that analysis to be dubious, well, just check out what is here. Again, this particular article by Peter Norman. If successful, the Nice summit will mark a further decisive stage in reversing the legacy of Second World War conferences at Tehran and Yalta. These condemned the continent to more than 40 years of Cold War division between East and West. But EU leaders face difficult negotiations in which they must give way on a variety of key national interests. The overriding imperative of making the EU fit for enlargement was underlined yesterday by a visit by Gerhard Schroeder, the German Chancellor, to the Polish capital of Warsaw. Skipping down, quote, "There is no better place than Warsaw to appeal to my colleagues in Nice to show courage and think together about the historic challenge of uniting Europe and bringing into the European Union the nations of Central and Eastern Europe and the Baltic states," he said. And again, just to evaluate my analysis in For the Record program 232 and also in RFA 37, even though the central element in 232, the merging of the London Stock Exchange and the Deutsche Börse, was eventually scotched by the stockholders of the LSE. Skipping down and continuing, "The meeting, known as the European Conference, will underline the commitment of both existing and future EU member states to a union that would one day stretch from the Atlantic to the borders of Syria, Iraq, and Iran." More about the German domination of the European Union and the use of peaceful, or relatively peaceful, and economic means to continue the work that Germany has engaged in for in several world wars, namely the job of ultimately, or the goal of ultimately, dominating Europe and the world. That has not been realized yet, but the century is as yet young. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the London Times. The London Times website, by the way, is at www.thetimes.co.uk. The Times is one word. This is from the London Times of December 6th of the year 2000. It's by Martin Fletcher and Philip Webster, and the London Times entitled this Secret Plan for EU Superstate. It reads in part as follows. Germany and Italy delivered a serious blow to Tony Blair on the eve of the Nice summit yesterday by calling for yet another round of negotiations to achieve an even closer European Union. In a confidential joint paper sent to France, which holds the EU's rotating presidency, Berlin and Rome said the summit should agree to hold an intergovernmental conference, or IGC, in 2004, quote, with a view to the further development of European integration, unquote. The Times has obtained the paper, which shows that even before the Nice Treaty is signed, leading EU members are looking for ways to increase integration in the next one. It immediately refueled Eurosceptic claims that the EU is on the road to becoming a superstate. Francis Maude, the shadow foreign secretary, called the document a, quote, bombshell that shows the true agenda at the heart of Europe, unquote. He claimed that the government was, again quoting, privately happy with this agenda, but publicly denies it is happening, unquote. One of the many ironies of the formation of the European Monetary Union, again, something which is putting a great deal of pressure on the United Kingdom and which is enhancing German economic control, not political control, but economic control of the continent, which end up, as we've dealt with in the past, and as indeed many people dating back to Thucydides have pointed out, economic control ultimately leads to political control. But the Tory party, the conservatives and ultra-conservatives in the United Kingdom, rather, are the main bulwark of opposition to the European Monetary Union. And again, this particular paper that was leaked to the London Times indicates that the plans for European integration will be increasing Germany's role in increasing Germany's power in the European Union. More on that same subject was discussed in the Financial Times of Tuesday, December 12th of the year 2000. This is an article by Haig Simonian in Berlin. That's last name S-I-M-O-N-I-A-N. It's headlined, Power Balance Swings in Favor of Berlin. It reads as follows. For all yesterday's attempts by German officials to play down talk of a decisive shift in relations with Paris after the Nice Intergovernmental Conference, the outcome suggests the pendulum had swung significantly in favor of Berlin. The point was virtually conceded by an advisor who noted that, whereas Franco-German dialogue may once have been, quote, necessary and sufficient, unquote, to drive the European program forward, it was now no more than, quote, necessary, unquote. The Franco-German pair, again quoting, the Franco-German pair is necessary to progress in Europe, but we have seen that more is required, and that will be even more so in an enlarged Europe, he said. Politically and economically, enlargement will decide... there's obviously a misprint in this Times article. Politically and economically, enlargement will decide... No, let me begin. Actually, this was my mistake. Politically and economically, enlargement will decisively alter Germany's role. The country will lie at the heart of the European Union, and the accession of new members from Eastern and Central Europe will open immense opportunities for its powerful exporters in what was once their backyard. But it is the institutional changes prompted by enlargement which have pinpointed the changing balance of power between the EU's guiding powers. At the dawn of integration, German politicians deferred to the French in a policy of deliberate restraint born out of the need to regain international respectability. By the 1960s, that lopsided relationship had become the central feature of European politics, as Konrad Adenauer, for example, gave way to General de Gaulle in keeping Britain out. Even late in the decade, as Willy Brandt steered his country gradually towards reconciliation with its eastern neighbors, Germany was an economic giant, but still a political dwarf, according to the Chancellor. While German confidence grew as its security needs decreased, the essential compact at the heart of the EU remained. The Franco-German axis, personified by Helmut Schmidt and Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, made the first tentative steps to economic and monetary union, and even surprisingly remained intact after German reunification in the unlikely partnership of François Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl. But the essential reassessment of the EU's organizational structure looks set to initiate a real change. German officials stressed yesterday that Berlin had deliberately refrained from pushing its demand for more weight in votes in the European Council in deference to its French partner. Quote, "We found a solution which did not significantly injure our most significant partner in Europe. We said Nice would not collapse on this question," said one. Unquote. But the Nice deal still acknowledged Germany's population is almost 40% larger than that of France through the recognition of demographic factors as an additional, quote, safety net, unquote, in voting, and through a relative rise in German representation in the European partner. So again, note that the Nice conference has indeed increased the power of Germany within the European Union. And I would also note that as we have dealt with in several broadcasts, including For the Record program number 179, during the German occupation of Europe in World War II, the corporate structures of the structures of the corporations in the occupied nations were altered in such a way as to make German corporations the dominant elements, the dominant partners in those corporate entities. Since after the German occupation was ended, there would necessarily have been, and in fact was, legal continuity between the occupation legal structure and that of post-war Germany in order to avoid complete chaos. The altering of the corporate structures in the various occupied nations in order to make German corporations dominant remained, and German economic control over corporations in the countries previously occupied by German troops remained even after the war. As we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record programs 99 and 102, the German plans for conquest in World War II entailed the use of German arms to gain an upper hand for German corporations, and then using that upper hand gained through arms, the German corporations would then re-enter world markets in an advantageous position. That has been realized in the post-war period, and that's something that should not be overlooked as one assesses the changes that are taking place in Europe and around the world. I would also note that one of the changes in the Nice Conference was to increase Germany's role in the European Parliament. Now, bearing in mind the German plan for the corporatist plan for conquest realized in World War II and perpetuated in the post-war period through the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I've dealt with in the past, consider the following. Also bear in mind that the European Parliament is disproportionately peopled by reactionary elements, including outright fascist elements, and so consider the following, and also bear in mind what I've discussed in the past with regard to German corporate control over the American and world media, and bear in mind the German corporatist plan for conquest. The following article comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, December 14th of the year 2000. This is a New York Times story by Paul Meller, M-E-L-L-E-R, datelined Brussels, Belgium, and headlined, "European Firms Get Poison Pill," unquote. Subtitled, "Vote Hurts Industrial Integration." The article reads in part as follows. A groundbreaking law intended to speed up industrial integration in Europe was stymied Wednesday when the European Parliament approved a measure that would permit the managers of a European company to fend off a hostile takeover bid without the permission of the shareholders. The Parliament also passed an amendment that would force companies to consult with unions or with their workforces before responding to a hostile bid. Another amendment obliges a target company to safeguard jobs when negotiating with an acquirer. Members of the European Parliament have argued that empowering managers to fend off hostile approaches without the consent of shareholders is simply providing them with defensive measures similar to the so-called poison pills that U.S. companies are allowed to use. They also argued that the measure would deter speculators from bidding up or down the price of the target company, and skipping down. By granting companies' management the right to fend off hostile takeovers without shareholder approval, quote, management could act to defend their own potentially narrower interests rather than being obliged to act in the interests of the target company's shareholders as a whole, unquote, Bolkestein said, again quoting, this could effectively hinder company restructuring on a pan-European level, unquote. Tim Cargill, C-A-R-G-I-L-L, a lawyer working for the takeover panel, said he was disappointed with the vote in the European Parliament. The amendment empowering company managers in a takeover situation, again quoting, runs contrary to one of the fundamental elements of the directive, unquote, he said. Now, as I've stated in past broadcasts, I do not want my analysis of the European Monetary Union and the German corporatist plan for conquest realized in World War II and in the post-war period through the Bormann Group and the European Monetary Union to be misunderstood as an endorsement of globalization. Globalization is a fact, and while I'm not crazy about it, analyzing its relative merits or demerits is a separate, though not altogether disconnected, question. The fact of the matter is, though, that the United States has no say in the European Monetary Union, and yet the European Union and European Monetary Union do have a very direct and significant say in American policies. The European Union's role in helping to deep-six the WorldCom-Sprint merger is an example of that. I would note again that that's not an endorsement of the WorldCom-Sprint merger or the increasing concentration of economic power, but the fact of the matter is the United States has no representative, it has no representation whatsoever in the European Union, and for the European Union to put the whammy on the merger of two American corporations represents a striking usurpation of national sovereignty. I would note again in the long-running series on German corporate control over the American media, the role of the Bertelsmann and von Holtzbrinck firms, as well as the role of Deutsche Telekom in some cases controlling, or in other cases gaining control of American media, is something that, well, that series talks about that, and the ability of corporate Germany to gain control of the United States and other countries, while at the same time American corporations will be hindered in their attempts to gain control of German corporations, is something that stands to follow naturally on this particular piece of legislation by the European Parliament. One of the things that I've noted in the many discussions about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization is that as the Third Reich went down, the liquid capital of the Third Reich was basically farmed out to 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries, and then after the war, that capital then flowed in to help make corporate Germany the powerful engine that it is today. As noted in the numerous discussions about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, control of the major German corporations is held through bearer bonds and holding companies, and it lies with the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Even non-anti-fascist observers, so to speak, of corporate Germany have noted the incestuous and very close German corporate climate. Many have dubbed that particular incestuous and close German corporate climate Germany Incorporated, and an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal of Monday, July 17th of the year 2000 by Christopher Rhodes, spelled R-H-O-A-D-S, datelined Berlin and headlined "New Tax Law Will Transform Germany Incorporated," discussed how the various German corporations are invested in one another. Now, I want to stress that Germany is not the only country in which corporations hold stakes in one another, but as indeed even relatively reactionary observers of the German business scene have noted, the various German corporations and the German core corporations essentially control one another. In our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, we've noted that the members of the boards of directors of the German core corporations sit in on German cabinet meetings, and in turn, German cabinet ministers sit in on the boards of directors meetings of the key German core corporations. In this particular article, there's a list of some of the cross-holdings in German corporations, and this is a list. This is sort of a manifestation of Germany Incorporated. A few of these that I'm going to cover here in the interest of time, but I'm not going to be able to read all of them due to the limitations of time, but by way of illustrating Germany Incorporated, the large German insurance company Allianz Holding, and again note the role of holding companies in maintaining control of corporate Germany for the Bormann Group, Allianz Holding has the following percentages in various corporations: BASF 10.4%, Bayer 5.0%, Bayerische Hypo and Vereinsbank 17.4%, BAWAG 4.4%, Continental, that's an oil company, 4.2%, Daimler Chrysler 1.1, Deutsche Bank 5.0, Dresdner Bank, 21.7. Skipping down, Monisman, 0.8. And Munich Reinsurance, 25.0. And Siemens, 2.6%. The Dresdner Bank. Allianz Holding, that's the company we just talked about, 10%. Bayerische Motorenwerk, that's the manufacturer of BMW, 5.0. Continental, again, the oil company, 5.3. Heidelberger Cement, 20.8. Metallgesellschaft, 13.5. Munich Reinsurance, 9.3. And skipping down, Munich Reinsurance, Allianz Holding, 25.0. Allianz Leben, 40.6. Deutsche Bank, 1.5. Hypo Vereinsbank, 5.0 to 10.0. And then the Deutsche Bank. Allianz Holding, 7.0. Daimler Chrysler, 11.9. Monisman Arcor, 7.5. Munich Reinsurance, 9.6. And then the Commerzbank, which along with Deutsche and Dresdner Banks are the big three of German banking. Skipping down, we read the Commerzbank holds 10.0 in Buderus, 9.9 in Heidelberger Druck, and so forth. The point being that even more than in other countries, the various German core corporations own one another, and this has, to a large extent, prevented corporate takeovers in Germany by foreign corporations, although the revamping of German tax laws was conducted in such a way as to alter that structure. It would appear that the poison pill legislation that was passed in the European Parliament, again, an institution which has a disproportionate representation by Nazis, fascists, and reactionaries than, say, the European Commission, the passing of that poison pill legislation by the European Parliament should help to block hostile takeovers of German corporations by foreign corporations, while at the same time the ability of German corporations to take over foreign corporations will remain unimpeded. In discussions of the European Monetary Union, I've discussed the fact that the euro, I predicted before the euro actually came into being, that the euro would be a weak currency, and that weak currency would in turn hurt the United States by making it relatively expensive for people in Europe to buy American manufactured goods, and in turn reducing the relative cost of manufactured goods in Germany to American consumers. That has in fact taken place, although the recent economic troubles in the United States have strengthened the relative value of the euro. The fact of the matter is the euro is a relatively weak currency, and that has in fact helped German manufacturers by boosting their exports. In a rare moment of candor, and something which earned Gerhard Schroeder a good deal of censure in European financial circles, Gerhard Schroeder stated that a weak euro was not something people should worry about, but rather it was something that they should celebrate. This was reported in, among other newspapers, the Financial Times of London of Thursday, September 7th of the year 2000. This is an article by Tony Barber in Frankfurt and headlined, Schroeder calm over euro dive irks currency's guardians. It reads in part as follows. In contrast to Gerhard Schroeder, the European Central Bank is not in the slightest happy about the euro's persistently low external exchange rate. The German Chancellor set the cat among the pigeons on Monday when he suggested that the euro's weakness gave reason for satisfaction because it had fueled a German export boom. Any suspicion that he had made the remark mistakenly in an unguarded moment seemed to be dispelled yesterday when a German government spokeswoman confirmed that Mr. Schroeder, quote, does not see the euro's current level as a cause for concern, unquote. And again, Schroeder has noted that the weak euro has in fact been very good for Germany's manufactured exports. And again, bear in mind my analysis of the European Monetary Union as the realization of the theories of pan-German theoretician and economist Friedrich Liest formulated in the 1840s. By the way, the paradigm on which Liest's theories were formulated was the temporary occupation of Europe by Napoleon, in which the economies of Napoleonic-occupied Europe were subjugated to that of France. That was the inspiration for the Liestian model. I've also noted that gradually Europe is taking steps to develop an independent military capability. And I think that the European Union, European Monetary Union, and now the EU Rapid Reaction Military Force signal the, in many ways, the end of American preeminence on the world stage. Even at the end of the Cold War, even as the Cold War has now ended, leaving the U.S. as, quote, the only superpower, unquote, I think American power is likely to be eclipsed during the coming century, as unlikely as that prospect may appear and in the present circumstances. William Cohen, the Secretary of Defense, has warned about the potential dangers to NATO of this European defense force. Among the many newspapers that carried that warning was again the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, December 6th of the year 2000. This is an article by Alexander Nicoll, N-I-C-O-L-L, in Brussels. It's headlined, U.S. warns EU defense force must be closely linked to NATO, and it reads in part as follows. William Cohen, U.S. Defense Secretary, warned yesterday that NATO would become a, quote, relic, unquote, unless the European Union's plans for an autonomous military capability were closely linked with the 19-member transatlantic alliance. And skipping down, the U.S. supports the EU plan for a rapid reaction force, which is due to be formally launched at the Nice Summit of EU leaders this week, but says it must remedy shortfalls shown in Kosovo last year. Again, note the formulation of an independent military capability by the European Union. The prediction in these quarters is that the next century will see the eclipsing of American power by the European Union and the European Monetary Union. I would note that the Eurozone countries have larger foreign currency reserves in the United States. More bonds were issued denominated in euros than in dollars last year. And we will see exactly what takes place in the future. But do note that the European Monetary Union and the European Union may very well wind up and will, in my prediction, wind up eclipsing American power in the next century. That should not be, again, misunderstood as an endorsement of all or even most of America's policies. As anyone who's a regular listener to the show knows, I'm very critical of much of what America has done. But nonetheless, as an American patriot, I would note the danger on the horizon to this country of what has taken place in Europe. More on the European military force and its potential danger to the continuity of NATO. The Financial Times of London of Monday, December 18th of the year 2000 carries the following article by Alexander Nicoll, defense correspondent. Its headline, Setback for EU's NATO Links, and it reads as follows. Plans to link, or Lee reads in part as follows, plans to link the European Union's planned rapid reaction force closely with NATO have been put back into the new year following failure to persuade Turkey to drop opposition in 2 days of ministerial talks. And skipping down. However, Turkey, the other NATO European member outside the EU, refused to budge on the crucial issue of the EU's assured access, unquote, to NATO's military planning staff. Without this, the EU initiative could be delayed or even founder completely, since Britain and many other members would not allow the EU to set up a rival planning staff independent of NATO. So whether that does wind up deep-sixing the European the European Union's military capability, or whether it winds up deep-sixing the continuity, the military continuity of the European Union and NATO, remains to be seen. There are a great many obstacles ahead on all horizons. I've alluded to Spitfire. You can access the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website. That concludes For the Record program number 266. This is being recorded on December 31st of the year 2000. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.